originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. This show, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. And I'm delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest, trainer Preston Ferris. At this taping, Preston has won 30 races and his charges have finished in the money 98 times in 299 starts. Although he is a Kentuckian, Preston plies his trade in Canada, racing mainly at Fort Erie and Woodbine. His stable is enjoying an excellent year with 2 wins in 2 seconds and 5 starts, with many more on the horizon. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Preston Ferris.
Thanks for having me on there, guys.
It's cool to have a trainer from Fort Erie. Fort Erie just opened last Tuesday, and you went right to the winner's circle. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, we had a couple down there, and Sniper come through there in the allowance race. He ran real well and made a big move at the end of the race there on the outside. And you know, he's a good old boy. He's 10 years old, so you know, it's nice to see him still with some fuel in the tank.
Yeah, I love those old horses. They're really great to have in the barn, and they know how everything works. So sometimes they can get a little cranky, but most of the time they're just very professional. Well, let's start at the beginning. Like many of the trainers featured on this program, you were born into the racing game. Tell us about growing up in a famous racing family.
Well, I was very fortunate. My papa, you know, he's known in Kentucky for being called Smiley Adams, and I guess he got that name because he didn't smile a whole lot. But yeah, William, my papa, he was a great man to be around. Thanked my butt enough times as a kid to, you know, teach me a lesson here and there. But he really helped out focusing when I was young. He knew that I had a big interest in being with the horses, and he focused on teaching me how to manage and train horses. I mean, I was young, but he'd give you the idea of what you could do with certain situations. And I mean, he helped out my mom a lot too, and the whole family is really into it. So, but having him as a grandpa, you know, really set things up for me mentally into the game. He didn't really explain the business side that much, and I think that comes with experience. But growing up with him, you know, he was good with training really good horses, and he was good with training cheaper horses. And, you know, he always told me there was a fine line about how, you know, the older they get, how do you train them, how aggressive you should be, or this or that. But they were in a different era where, you know, the vets weren't as popular, and now the vets were a little bit, you know, you're busy, people are a lot busier with the vets, but, you know, the rules and regulations have cut that back too. So it's nice to see the game sort of go back to an old era, sort of, where it's more horsemanship than it is business.
Well, Smiley Adams, he was just a horseman's horseman. I remember the first time I went to Latonia, which is what Turfway used to be called. They had all of the winners of the Spiral Stakes and the big races. Their stats and their the silks of the winners and stuff painted on the wall at Latonia above the grandstand. It was just beautiful. And like every other horse, or maybe every horse sometimes, was Smiley Adams, Smiley Adams, Smiley Adams. And I was lucky enough to meet him back in the day. He won the Jim Beam Spiral Stakes, which is now called the Jeff Ruby Stakes, 4 years in a row.
And if I'm not mistaken, he won it more times than that, but he did win it 4 times in a row, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then his son, I'm assuming that's your uncle, Jasper Adams, won the race as well in 1982.
Yeah, my great uncle, yeah. He's the Gallup Master Derby.
Wow. Yeah, Master Derby. Yeah, your grandfather won the Preakness, which is the highlight of his career, I would imagine. With Master Derby, and Master Derby was a fine horse and a good sire later on. And when I was doing research for this program, I noticed in Equibase they don't have Master Derby as winning the Preakness under your grandfather's stats, and they don't have him winning the Preakness, your grandfather. So I'm going to get that changed. I have a couple of friends over at Equibase, and I'm going to make sure that they give him full credit for that. I don't know how that slipped through the cracks. That was kind of crazy. But
yeah, I didn't know that, actually, to tell you the truth. I always, I got most of those pictures, and I mean, you know, I know I've seen that picture at home at my nanny's house, and definitely they were in the winner's circle. So
yeah, no, it's a known fact. It's not even a little known fact. It's a hugely known fact. But I'm gonna get that fixed. I'm gonna call over there and get that fixed for you, because I think it's very important. Your grandfather was huge. At that time, he was one of the biggest names in the country. And did you get to hang out at the barn with him much?
No, see, now he passed away when I was about 18 when he passed away, and I was living with him, and obviously he passed away with emphysema, and he did have a little. He liked to smoke back in the day, but he was a Marine for one term, so I'm guessing he got to smoking while he was in the service there. But he was done training when I was real young, so I was probably, I believe I was about 10 years old or so when he stopped training. He retired because he got sick, and so his health just wasn't up to doing it anymore. And, the time when he went to retire, he had a bunch of, cheaper horses, and he was focused on, River Downs and those places, and, he just called it, he knew it was time to focus on his health and try and have a handful of good years before he passed away, right?
Yeah. Well, that's, that's what happens a lot of times as trainers age, their clients do too, and most of the time their clients are older than they are. They have the money and wherewithal to be able to get into the horse business. But a lot of times as a trainer gets older, and I believe your grandfather died when he was 67, a lot of his clients die off, and that really hurts a trainer when that starts happening.
Yeah, for sure. That Golden Chance Farm, they really had a good program, right? They had really good program. Now, I don't know a whole lot about them. My papa used to talk real highly of them, and they bred well, and they always had good stock, and I'm not mistaken, they won the Derby with a horse the early 70s, correct?
They won
Dust Commander, or
they had Run Dusty Run. He finished second in the Derby.
He ran second in the Derby.
He was second in the Belmont too, and third in the Preakness. That was Seattle Slough's year, so nobody won anything but Seattle Slough.
No. But if Master Derby, the year Master Derby won it, I believe that was Foolish Pleasure's year too, right?
Right, right.
So he sort of took away from a possible Triple Crown horse there as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like you said, he was a big man around campus. He won 672 races in his career, and 1219. He was in the money about 2,000 times, made $9.2 million in purses. Now, in today's money, that doesn't sound like a lot, but believe me, in those days, that was a lot of money.
I think the Preakness was, what, $150,000 when he won it, so.
Yeah, a little different today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. So when you said you were 18 when he passed away, did like his brother, or did you hang out with any other members of the family as you were?
I live just down the. So I graduated high school in West Jessamine. Go Colts, right? So but some of my high school, we lived up in Georgetown. And so I lived in Scott County there for, you know, a hand of maybe 2 years. And we just lived down the road from Jasper and his wife, Karen, and like just a couple houses down the road. And so I know Jasper really well. And, you know, he was a good old man, too. And he was a good horseman, too.
So. Yeah, he had a nice career. Were you even alive when Master Derby was running?
No, God, no. I'm 32, so I was born in 87. So
yeah, I didn't think so.
Way before my time, but you just you glow in all the pictures. You know, when you see the pictures, and you're just like, you know, as my papa, and that's my family, and it still makes you really proud to be a part of it. And it's funny because now, I mean, you look at all those years gone by, and you go anywhere in the state of Kentucky, and you talk about Smiley Adams, and they're like, everybody in the horse racing industry really knows. You know, they still know who that is, and that's pretty cool to say that he's my papa.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I think I was really amazed because I didn't know that you were a Kentuckian. We just got introduced about a week ago, and I didn't know you were a Kentuckian. You bleed blue and all of that. So,
I'm a true blue fan, but I have to say, being up here, I'm sort of. Kawhi Leonard fan right now. We're sort of cheering on the Raps. So
yeah, they're doing all right. That's pretty exciting. So you know, when you have a Kentuckian training in Canada, that's kind of unique. How did you end up in Canada?
So I have family up here, and you know, I got a big tree of family everywhere. So I came up here when I was 22. I would have been just about to turn 22. And I went out west to a province called Alberta. And went to the track there, and somebody asked me if I wanted a job. And I said, well, I might be here for a minute, so I might as well make some money. So I started galloping there at a racetrack called Stampede Park. And then they switch up to Northlands Park, and so I started galloping there a little bit, and then I said, well, you know, a year of this, it's a sort of a bull ring track, and it's good horse racing for a smaller track. You know, it's a small track, and the people are, you know, they're just all there doing the same thing as everybody else, trying to hustle and make a dollar. And I decided to come out to Woodbine that fall, and I stayed. I met my wife, and my wife Tanya, and everything was real good. And I decided to stay, and I ended up having a son, and my son's named Lucas. He's named after one of my best friends. His middle name's after one of my best friends' dad. Their name's Anthony Apro. They own racehorses in Kentucky, and so I decided to try and make a go of it up here, and it's. You know, it's a good spot to run horses, and the money here is real good. If you're running at Woodbine or even Fort Erie, the money is good, right? And it all spends the same way. So I've been up here. I do plan on coming home, but you know, when it's time, then we can ship down there. You know, it's all about making sure everything's secure for my family. So
yeah, that's always important. When did you decide that you wanted to be in the horse business? Was it just that fact that you ran into that job, or did you dream about it when you were a kid?
Oh man, I used to convince my mom, I shouldn't say this, but my mom was training there, and she had, I don't know, she used to train for that Castle Rock stud. I can't remember the guy's name. I was so young. Maybe his name was Jamie or something. And they didn't have the greatest horses, but my mom did real well for them. And I was doing really good in school, and my grades were good. So she'd always let me skip school on Fridays, and I'd come down to the track. And, you know, some days she'd get up real early and go to leave. And I'd ride my bicycle from, this is when we were living in Georgetown, I'd ride my bicycle from the horse park all the way to the training center. When I was 13, 14 years old, freshman in high school, riding my bike all the way to the track, and my mom said, well, we're in trouble.
So, yeah, that's a little bit of a schlep. It shows your desire to be around the horses.
Yeah, I loved them. And I started galloping at a real early age. I probably had a little favoritism because I'm pretty sure I wasn't supposed to be galloping, but because of my family, you know, they let me go out there when I was probably shouldn't have been out there, but I was pretty decent at it, even at a young age. And I actually I don't talk to these people much anymore, but John Langmeyer, his wife, Clara, she's a vet there. And she taught me how to ride on her farm. I haven't talked to them in years, but she really taught me how to sit on a horse real good. And tried helping me with my grammar too, but that didn't work out very well. So. But she taught me how to ride, you know, have a good seat on a horse. And then I went from that to start riding horses at the track. And for a stint there, my mom was Larry DeMerritt's assistant way back in the day. She had taken a year off from training, and so she was working for Larry. And Larry used to let me tack walk horses there at Keelan in the barn, because the hot walkers would get mad if I was hot walking all their horses, because they'd lose money out from this little kid right on the weekend. So he said, well, we'll just let you start tack walking some, so we'll keep the hot walkers happy. So that's sort of how it all started. And then, Keelan, they had old Bob was the outrider back then. I'm sure you're familiar with Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
So Bob let me start coming out. Once he thought I was capable of, you know, getting him around the track real good, then he gave me the okay to start getting on a few and coming out late in the morning. I was maybe 14 or so. And he let me get out, you know, those things you could sort of slide, you know, they were a little bit old. Okay back in the day. Nowadays they probably couldn't get away with doing things like that, but Bob treated me really good, and he sort of babysat me out there, and that's sort of where it all began. And then I just kept galloping on the weekends, and I was 18. I went down to Ocala, Florida, and galloped for Karen Dunn at Waver Tree Stables, and I just started paying attention a little more to the training aspect and the sort of follow people around that were setting the feeds, and I like to think that I become really good at feeding horses. So the feeding program is a very important part of horse racing. So that's, you know, a lot of people, you know, they had to feed too much or don't feed enough, or so if you can get a good science down to it, you know, I was doing that, and Karen was really good to work for when I was down there. And he taught me how to break horses properly. And I got to deal with some pretty nice horses at Waver Tree Stables. And then I kept moving around a little bit. And I got better at it. And I was assistant for a guy named Greg Tracy for a couple years. He's from Montana now. He bases out of Western Canada most of the time. But he takes horses. I believe he had string down in Sunland Park this winter. And he sort of goes everywhere. But I got to work with him, and he's a phenomenal trainer, and I've been blessed to learn a lot of things with two-year-olds with him. Now, unfortunately, my stats with two-year-olds aren't as great as I'd like. That's one thing that I'd, you know, like to progress in, as having two-year-olds, because you need them young ones to keep going, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I worked for a lot of good trainers. I mean, I worked for Mark Cassie up here at Woodbine. I galloped for him, and he was great to work for. Fast-moving barn. Big time horses, you know, you learn a lot when you're getting on those kind of those caliber of horses. And there's other guys up here too, that helped me along the way. There's a trainer up here named Donnie McCray. He's a really good horseman. And then that guy, you know, the guy that won 100 and some races last year up here, you know, Norm McKnight, he taught me how to, you know, he got me into understanding more about the feet, and he actually probably was the reason I won my very first race ever as a trainer, because I had this horse that used to hit real bad, and I was in his barn, and he showed, you know, he watched her walk and whatnot, and he said, you know, try putting some wedge shoes on her behind and square toe her up front, and she had gone out there. She was 25-1. I think she won by 5 or 6 lengths that day. I don't think we ever hit the board again after that, but with her, but she won, and, you know, those guys, they're really smart when it comes down to feeding and training and blacksmithing and all that stuff. So, but back to the main part of the question, I just always been in it, and there was no way I wasn't going to be part of it.
That's
and
cool.
Coming out of high school, I was looked at, you know, I had a couple invitations to go to Morehead State for football. And I was small and wasn't as fast as most of the other kids that were getting looked at. And I said, you know, I just didn't really want to be a hitting dummy for 5 years. So I decided just to stick with what I knew. And I did try to become a jockey. I was big when I left high school, but I lost a lot of weight, and I got down to weight, but I could never really get passed by a doctor because I looked so damn skinny, but could never really get it. You know, I got down to 113 pounds, and I thought there I could get it and keep it like that, but I was just, like, I'm about 5'8", and 113 pounds was just really skinny, so I stuck with a pitchfork and a trainer's license, so...
And it's worked out good for you.
Yeah, it's working out good. I've got great clients, you know, and that's always been a blessing. I've always had very, very good clients. Not as many of them as I'd want, excuse me, but the clients that I have, they make it really enjoyable to stay in the game, like, because they've stuck with me through the tough times, and I'm sure, you know, you have trained before, so, you know, there's tough times, and there's probably more tough times than great times. So having those owners, they really sort of keep you going. And, you know, even if their horse doesn't win, if they run good, they're happy. So it sort of makes your job a lot easier. And, you know, being around the horses has always been my number one goal, though. I haven't always been the greatest people person, to be honest. I know it's sort of bad for business. I try to. I've always, Donnie McCray, you said he's a trainer up here at Woodbine. He said there's always got to be compromise in you. The business side of things, you got to learn how to deal with owners and talk to them and compromise that sometimes, even when it, you know, might not be the right thing to do, or, you know, how you're running a horse over its head, or, you know, or whatever. But he sort of helped me out a lot to learn how to compromise with clients, and that helped out a big part of my career as well. So.
That's good. You've picked up little things from almost everybody that you work for, and I think that's really good that you had a variety of teachers. You know, there's different ways to get into training and to learn the craft, but when you take your time to go around and learn from different people, because somebody will teach you something different at every job that you go to. So I think that's a great way to do it, and you know, you've obviously learned a lot. I think most trainers universally say the horses are the easy part. It's the owners and the business that's the hard part for most trainers. I mean, you know, if you could just get up in the morning and go train your horses, life would just be lovely. But you got to pay the bills, and you got to deal with the clients, and that's the harder part of the whole thing.
Oh, that's for sure. I mean, the horses, you all you got to do is listen to them, and they'll tell you. You know, it's just that you got to listen hard enough, and they can help you out along the way. You know, I got a couple of horses up here, like, two horses I ran down in Fort Erie the other day, one won and one ran second, and between the two of them, there's 18 years of horses, you know.
Yeah.
That's one was 10 and one's 8, and they, you know, they both, Snipers made over 400,000, and I think Too Many Egg Birds, he's around I think he's made about 300 and some thousand. But those horses, they just keep on going. But they really tell you, you know, some days they have better days than others. You know, they're not young bucks no more. So they don't. I did work for Roger Atfield too. I got some really nice horses for him. Sand Cove, Samard, Society's Chairman, bunch of nice horses that he had up here at Woodbine, and you know, he'd be walking out on some of these nice horses for him, and he'd always tell you, you know, you walk out there, and he sort of has the same program because he was a much bigger barn at the time. So a lot of horses typically train the same way, but he'd always have a few of them that he trained different. And, you know, I was a little bit younger at the time, so I'd be like, well, what are we doing with him, Roger? And he'd be like, just wait. I'll tell you when we're ready. And he'd be walking out on the pony, and he'd always study their eyes. And he said, you can learn a lot by studying a horse's eyes. You they'll tell you, you know, and it, at that age, you sort of think the guy's sort of crazy. But like that too many egg burst, you can tell when you're looking into his eye, you can tell when he's good and when he's not. There's some days, you know, he's 8 years old, so some days he goes out there and he's a little bit mopey, and some days he goes out there and you can't keep his feet on the ground. So, you know, you sort of try and judge it off of that. But, yeah, those experiences were huge.
Yeah, well, working for a Hall of Fame trainer, that's got to be pretty cool. Did he have those stuffed animals in his stalls like he did now when you were working for him?
Yeah, to be quite honest, that wasn't a huge thing he had. At the time, it wasn't a super huge thing. But then it got, he ended up, who was it? Maybe it was, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been Allie Walker, which I believe is his assistant right now. And if I'm not mistaken, it was her. There was another, he had another assistant just before her, Patrick Dixon, which he had worked for Roger for a couple of years. And I think he won the Transylvania down there at Keeneland with that a couple of years ago. What was that horse's name? I can't remember the horse's name, but it might have been Patrick that started the teddy bear thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's quite funny to walk through a shed row. You know, you got 35 head of horses, and they all got these big old stuffed animals all over the place.
Yeah, I was amazed when I saw it the first time. That's really wild.
Yeah, it's definitely different than the old. I sort of go the old school way, and I recycle and reuse. And you know, we got a couple horses there in the barn. We use them. You know, you'll reuse a supplement jug or something, and a couple of my young horses like to toss those around. And you know, you like to use those bouncy balls or whatever, but they're getting, just to buy one of those bouncy balls now, it's $30 or so. They just get so expensive. So I like to recycle a little bit.
Yeah, I totally get you. Well, we're visiting with trainer Preston Ferris on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And we're going to come back and talk some more and hear more of his interesting story after these words.
Calling all racehorse owners. Nominations are now open for the Fasig Tipton July Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale. Delivering record results to sellers, this sale has quickly established itself as the nation's premier Horses of Racing Age Sale. Fueled by 28 horses selling for $100,000 or more, including the $700,000 sale topper My Miss Tappet. Last year's sale achieved a record gross and produced an average price of more than $90,000. Race to the top of the market. The Fasig Tipton July Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale. July 8th in Lexington, Kentucky.
Attention, Kentucky breds. Make plans to race at the upcoming Kentucky Downs meet starting August 31st, where Kentucky breds compete for huge purses. Kentucky breds will run for $130,000 in maiden events, with allowance races offering up to $145,000, the highest in the nation. With just 5 days of racing, showcasing 14 stakes races and 4 graded stakes, with additional purse money available for KTDF eligible horses, Kentucky Downs is the place to race a Kentucky bred this summer. Visit KentuckyBred.org for details.
For a commercial farm like us in Frankfurt Park, you have to get value for money. Uvetsi won a grade 3 in California.
Big performance by Uvetsi.
And then we bred Take Charge Paula.
Take Charge Paula with the win.
When we can get some of these Windsor dollars, as far as we're concerned, it's the same as real money, because we're just putting it back in again there for the coming year. Over the next couple of years, I think it's going to become even more important.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win, going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizou with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, why focus on the nose? Isn't the throat a big problem in racehorses?
Mike, when we think about the upper airway in horses, we typically end up putting on a tongue tie or operating on its throat to improve airflow. What you may find interesting is that when we measure the anatomy of the upper airway and the flow, the narrowest part that causes the greatest resistance in all horses is the nasal passages. That's where the strips work. If you want to improve airflow to the lungs, you need to consider the nasal passages.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Wheeling out widest is Sniper into the top of the stretch. Kitten Solution, the top of the stretch leader, selling out. They're stalked on the grandstand side by Sniper. Marriage Counselor is not giving it up very easily, but Kitten Solution and Luis Contreras have the late stretch lead. Sniper is still coming. Here comes Sniper at Kitten Solution. Late, it's Sniper at a 12-1. Running down Kitten Solution, Marriage Counselor, and then selling out Sniper and Jeffrey Alderson at a 12-1. Run the 6.5 furlongs, 117 1/5.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld, and I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Back with our conversation with trainer Preston Ferris. Opening day at Fort Erie. Wow, that was a good day for you, a win in a second.
Yeah, it was a very good day. Thank you.
What does that feel like when you win on opening day? You're like automatically leading trainer.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've been held up yesterday too because they ran there yesterday. So first time in my life, I can say I'm officially a leading trainer for 2 weeks.
There you go. I love that. I won the first race at Del Mar on opening day one time. That was a good feeling.
Yeah, you know, that's, those kind of horses, you know, I sort of made a living on those kind of horses. And Sniper, he's a Canadian bred horse, but he's by a sire named Trajectory. And I've had a couple of them before, and they just love the dirt. And a race for him, you know, they just weren't going up at Woodbine at the time. And I just said, you know what, I know he's 10 years old. He's never run on the dirt. And I'd really like to give him a shot on it and see. I guess that we know he likes the dirt. So, you know, up here, if you don't go to Fort Erie, you just don't really have the opportunity to run on dirt, right? So, he's just one of those old classy horses that just, Barb Minchell bred him. She ran him. I mean, he made a bunch of money with her. And to have him, you know, I don't like to make myself look like a wuss or nothing, but every time that horse runs like that, you know, he really, really puts a light in you. You know, he just puts that, he knows how to re-fire, you know, turn that fire light inside you back on, you know, if you're having a little bit of a bad week or this or that. And when you have a 10-year-old that can go out there and just, you know, that's back-to-back winners. And he won the start before that at Woodbine as well. So, you know, when they're 10 years old, you know, to go down to Fort Erie, and some people up here don't really like going down to Fort Erie. You got to ship, and in Canada up here, they don't really like shipping. And they get worried about, you know, if the horse will ship well or this or that. And I'm like, well, we're so used to it in Kentucky, right? Like, you're basically shipping everywhere. So it's not, it's different up here if you're, you can be at Woodbine and base here for 9 months and you really don't have to go nowhere.
Yeah, that's a unique situation in Canada because Woodbine's the all-weather track. And you know, you mentioned the fact that if you want to run your horse in the dirt, you got to go to Fort Erie to do it, you know, especially, you know, locally. So that's got to, you know, probably get you a few horses along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope. I mean, having a high percentage doesn't hurt either. It's, you know, it's like I I'd like to try and say, you know, up here, the amount of owners, it's just not like in Kentucky where you have, you know, I'm just throwing out a number, but there's probably 10,000 partial owners or so in Kentucky. And up here, you know, you're probably looking at maybe at best there's maybe 500 clients. And it is a very tough place to get in the door because there's so many classic trainers here. You got Bobby Tiller, you got Roger Affield, Mark Cassidy, you got Mike DiPaolo, Josie Carroll, Catherine Day. Like, when these owners, they switch from, you know, the kind of caliber of horses that you'd like to walk into, those owners typically go, if they do leave one barn or take horses from one barn but leave some at that barn, whatever, they typically go to another top guy. So for the younger guys, it is a tough place to get going. And I've always probably, I'll be honest with you, I'm sort of a when I was younger, I was a lot more voiceful and opinionated. The older I get, the little bit better I've been at, to be honest, biting my tongue sometimes. And like I told you before, that I'm a pretty honest person, and I believe in horse racing. But to get clients up here, it is a very difficult place. It's not that easy as, you know, say Norm McKnight. I mean, he won 120-some races here last year, and he did it mainly with the one client, Bruno Schickendance. And, you know, he runs at a very high percentage. And it's still tough. When I first come here, he was winning 10, 15 races. He didn't have as big as a barn. Now I think he's got like 55, 60 head up here. And it took him years to get there. And he's always been known for a high percentage guy, but he's always been a small barn. So imagine if it's a guy that can run at the percentage like him and be successful and do good and still have troubles or say took him 10 years or 12 years, 15 years to get to where he is. You know, it's not a quick turnaround up here. And you got to be very lucky to get good clients.
Yeah, because, you know, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for people that want to have a future in the business themselves and you know, want to do well and are willing to work with you and listen to you. And those good clients, the ones that support you, they're invaluable no matter where you train. But it is a kind of an island situation up there in Canada where there's the two tracks and that's about it. It's very similar to like California, say, where there's two tracks and that's it. So you have to nurture those people that take care of you. How do you get most of your horses? Do you claim them? Do you buy them privately? Do you go to sales? How's that go?
I'd like to do a lot more at the sales. It is tough when you're up here. You got the one Canadian sale. I do like to come home down to Kentucky and look, but, you know, unfortunately, I'd like to think I got a pretty good eye, but the eye doesn't usually fit the budget. So, you know, as I've come down there, I bought a really nice yearling a year ago out of the January sale at Keeneland, and he's by Courageous Cat and out of a New York bred stake one in mare. And he's a really, really nice three-year-old colt now, but he's 18 hands. He's a good-looking horse. He's big, and it's, you know, process when you're buying those babies. And, you know, I'd never imagine him getting so big. So he's been, you know, sort of one of those stories where I was sort of hoping to run him as a two-year-old and possibly sell him because, you know, New York-bred horses are selling like hotcakes. And, because I haven't gotten them to the races yet, you're just sitting on them, right? And but preferably, I would like to buy a lot more in the sale. Now, clients that I have now, you know, they've been in the game for a long time, and they've never claimed horses until they came to me. They used to breed a lot, and this and that. And the breeding program up here it slowed down a lot, and so I convinced them to claim a horse, and the very first horse they ever claimed was that Too Many Egberts. And, you know, we claimed him, and he's done nothing but, I mean, I maybe in my, since the time I claimed that horse, I don't know, heck, we've made over 100 and some grand with him in 2 years, and he's probably a number of, let's say, 60% in the top three. And it doesn't matter if I run him in Fort Erie or at Woodbine. He's won on every surface that's ever been made: tapeta, poly, turf, dirt, at any distance from 5/8 to a mile. He's a very versatile horse. But the claiming game is fun. It's a tough game because you just don't know what you're getting. But I like to claim horses. I really never really wanted to be a claiming trainer, but the clientele hasn't really showed up like I'd want. So to keep refilling the barn or keep putting horses in stalls, you know, sometimes you got to get into that claiming game a little bit more than you'd want. And it's worked out really well. I mean, I've done good with all the horses I've ever claimed. And, I think I've won with every single one, exception of a couple that I may have sold or something after claiming them that I didn't want to, I didn't maybe like how they were or whatnot. So, you sort of try and get rid of them before they become a cost, right? So, but every horse, Sniper, I claimed him from Barb Mitchell. I've claimed some from a guy up there named Marty Drexler. I've done good with all those. And Marty, he's another very good trainer up here at Woodbine. He's got a big, big barn. He comes from Western Canada as well. But I try and I like the claiming game, but I'd much rather, be walking into a barn with horses from the sales that they paid $200 for. I don't really have the luxury right now in my career, but it's definitely something that I'd love to get the opportunity to be at the sale more and interact with those people. I mean, there's so much old money still in the game, especially in Kentucky. When you're at the sale, there's a lot of old money and prestige people, people that have been in the game for 50 years, 60 years. And that's part of the game. The business side of it is interacting with those people, and it's fun. When I go home to Kentucky and I do those sales, it's fun to see those people. And they're all busy working on reading the books, and they're looking at horses. And, even up here in Canada, when you go to the CTHS sale and you're looking at these Canadian-bred horses, and there's lots of clients there, and, Todd Pletcher buys a lot up here too. I mean, he's bought some nice horses out of the sale, and he's bought horses, Canadian-bred horses, that say come down to the Kentucky sale and sell there. And, I mean, Pletcher's busy running horses up here all the time, and they like coming up here as well. I mean, it's good money to come up here. You just sort of lose on the return factor, right, with the U.S. dollar. So, but the sales definitely I love. Like I said, though, it's just usually the ones that I like. They're always out of my price range at the moment. So,
well, that comes with more experience and more success at the sales. I mean, you only need one horse to turn things around. If you buy one at the sale that turns out to be a stakes winner or something, and people take notice. So as long as you're patient, which I know you are, you're a very patient guy. So it's gonna happen for you. I know it will, and you just have to wait till that day comes. But in the meantime, if you can claim a few horses and get your client's kitty up a little bit, you can take 20 or 30 grand and come down here and find one of those diamonds in the rough.
Yeah, that's what you want to look for. I did. There was a old show jumping guy that used to mess around with racehorses here and there, and he'd always go and buy those horses for he'd always try and find those horses you can buy cheap and that have good form or good numbers, and they're always consistent. They might not be superstars, but you might just be able to have fun with them. And they might not make you a whole lot of money, this or that. But sometimes, you go buy a horse for $2,000, and you never know. Horses like California Chrome and those kind of horses, you could walk into one of those one day, and your whole world, in 2 minutes of horse racing, your whole world can be turned around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's such a odd business in that, like, you can work at other businesses, and the harder you work, the the richer you get, the more famous you get, whatever. Horse racing, you can work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and you make less money sometimes than you would if you had a minimum wage job at a fast food restaurant. You know?
Yeah.
There's no hard work is no guarantee that you're going to be successful in horse racing.
No, you know? Not at all.
And that's because everybody works hard. Everybody that has horses, they all have to get up at, you know, 4 a.m. and go train and do all the things you got to do. And you know, some people are winning races in bunches and other people are just hoping they could get to the winner's circle. So
it's a 7-day job. You know, it's tough to days off are few and far between. And you have easy days and this and that, but you know, like you said, the time clock ticks and you could be there all day. You know, we run, say we have racing tonight at Woodbine, and I mean, think of it, the people that work all day, the grooms, the hot walkers, the trainers, the riders, and even jockeys. Like jockeys up here do a lot of work. They breed a lot of horses at Woodbine, more so than, you know, a lot of places. You know, jockeys really work hard up here to get their business going. And even the ones that have great business, like Eureka Rosa da Silva and Louis Contreras and the Bug Boy up here, Tamira and those guys, they work hard. They go and they're breeding horses every day. You know, some of them breeding 6, 7, 8, 9 horses a day. And, you know, you just work. But say on a day today, I mean, if you're working in a big barn and you got one or two horses running on a Wednesday night in the last race, I mean, they're putting in a 20-21 hour day, and that goes unseen. Nobody knows about those and how hard grooms and hot walkers have to, how hard their life is, and they don't make a lot of money doing it. So, you know, those people like me, we thrive off of good help. And the guy that works for me is like an assistant. He's trained before, and you know, he's really good leg man and does a good job on my horses, and those things are the main, those things really help a trainer out, you know, and their time is never paid properly, but it's, you know, it's sort of how this game is, and it's, you like to pay them as much as you could, but it is, like you said, they work a lot, and they might not make as much as some people on minimum wage when it comes onto a Wednesday. If you're there at 4 a.m. and you don't leave till 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah, sometimes it can be quite a tough life. But, you know, most of us wouldn't trade being with the horses for anything. I mean, that's the horses are the common denominator, don't you think?
For sure. Like you were saying earlier in the interview there about, you know, if you could just come in and not have to worry about talking to too many people and just dealing with the horses. The horses are what make this game. It's everything about the horses. And, you know, I've worked for Danny Vella before, and, you know, he gives one of the best interviews out there. And, you know, it doesn't matter how hard his team or him put into an idea to a good horse. It just doesn't matter. The credit 110% always goes to the horse. Like, you know, if it wasn't for the horse, you know, sometimes the horses just make you look really good. Doesn't matter, you know, don't get me wrong, those people give credit where credit's due to their grooms and their riders, and Danny Vella, he's a very classy man like that. And but he'll say good horses make us look like we're intelligent. But at the end of the day, they are the point for most people to be back here. And you know, sometimes you get a bad horse and they're tough to deal with or this or that, but I've dealt with bad horses, and it's actually a little bit entertaining and fun to learn how can you teach this horse to relax or become better or not try and do this or that that's rude or try and drop you, or you know how it can go. We just get some horses that are just much more difficult to deal with. But to me, it's a test. You know, and it's, or even horses that don't eat as well, and you're trying to figure out, could it be this or could it be that, or, you know, the different combinations of feed that you could feed. It's fun. And all you have to do is listen to the horse. And, but like you were saying, if it wasn't for them, you know, the people that care for them, and they're all there because of the horses. They didn't, just come there. Most of them didn't just come there for a paycheck, you know. Most of them are there because the enjoyment they get from the horses.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, you make a good point. That's what makes a trainer's job so fun. It's addicting to take this animal who maybe isn't the best runner or has a bad attitude or whatever, and work with them and mold them into a useful racehorse. Somebody that knows what they're doing when they go out there and enjoys the game and runs their best. And that's the satisfaction that we get when we turn a horse around.
Oh, that's 100% true. Like, I mean, you just like, you know, I hate to keep going back to Sniper all the time, but him being a 10-year-old, like, he's a character in the barn. You know, he acts like a 2-year-old. You know, he's just a good feeling horse. He's pretty easy to maintain, and really, he's all business when you go out there to train. Like, and he can be pretty tough. I mean, you have to have an experienced rider on his back, but he's fun, and you know, you walk into the barn, he knows it's feed time, and I mean, he'll halfway run out of his stall webbing and just to nicker as loud as he can to scream, "Feed me, let's go." You know, he's a good doer that way. And you know, they talk to you, they just play with you, and they, you know, you go in there to brush him. He don't like getting brushed much, but you go in there and you brush him, and he wants to play with you, to push you around, and he's not vicious about it. Now you get some horses that are, you know, a little bit more mean about things, but the character of the horse is a big deal. Like, but turning him around, and Bart, you know, I can't say I turned Sniper around. Bart Mitchell did really well with him, and but to keep him going, I mean, I've had him for a year and a half. Or usually, you know, you don't have in the claiming game, you wouldn't have a 10-year-old around now. You know, he is 10, so most people, you know, they sort of not look at them to claim because they are, you know, almost at the end of their, usually they're past their time and they're done by then. But that horse, he just loves doing it.
Yeah.
Every time he goes out there. Now he's an off-the-pace sprinter, so, you know, sometimes the races just don't set up for him. And, you know, going from 6 furlongs to 7/8, and if you got a 7/8 race that just don't set up a good half, you know, it's tough for him to close on them because they just sort of run away from you when you turn for home. But up here, if you get the right pace, and that he just goes out there and he just keeps coming, keeps running. And he comes back to the barn, and he knows if he run good, he comes back to the barn. And if he didn't do that good, you know, he's just so experienced that, you know, you can see that there's a sour look.
Yeah, they know, don't they? Yeah. Oh. That's how old horses are. Well, would you consider him your best claim ever?
No, really, tell you the truth, too many Egberts. I've had him a little bit longer. I claimed him for 10,000 at Woodbine, and I ran him right off the claim. They were running those backwards races, and this is why I picked him out, because he was a really good turf horse, and Paul Buttigieg was who I claimed him off of, and he had done really well with him on the turf. So there was one of those backwards races, and I said, you know what, I can claim this horse right now for 10 and run him back for 16 in one of these backwards races, and they won't beat him. And we got in a little bit of trouble. That was the first start back off the claim, and that turn there, coming in, you know, it's sort of a long turn on that turf track, but the first turn you come to, it's like a hairpin turn. It's really sharp, and the horse got in a little bit of trouble, and he blew the turn. He must have been, I don't know, 14, 15 wide coming around the turn, and he was the easy winner. Like, he would have galloped in that race. He ran second, got beat by half a length or something, and he got disqualified. But he was way out of it. And that was only going 5.5 furlongs, and he still almost won the race. And Canada, like I said, he got disqualified, but come back, he runs second. You know, I brought him down to Kentucky that winter, run him at Turfway for allowance. You know, so I claimed the horse for 10, and I brought him to Turfway for allowance going a flat mile. And I don't know, he's probably like 10 to 1 or something like that, but I just, you know, I knew he'd get the distance, and he just, I had, who did I have on him? I can't remember. He'll come to me, but good jockey, too. But we just got beat by a nose on the wire, and I didn't really like the way he come back, so I put him away, and it sort of cut my home trip to Kentucky a little short that winter. So I was a little bit sour about that. But every year I come down there, he just barely got beat for 40 down there, and then I brought him back up here and just barely got beat in the 20 starter going 7 furlongs here by Norm McKnight. I think he beat me by a nose. And I think I rambled off a couple winners with him that year. And then last year he had a few winners. I think maybe he had two wins last year. But he's very consistent. He's, always second, third, 1, 2, 3. He's always pounding at the door. And like I said, I think I claimed him for 10, and we're over, somewhere like 120,000 with him in the 2 years that I've had him. Yeah, it's not a whole lot of money, but he's paid his way and some other horses. So, Sniper, I won 4 races with him. Last year at the end of the year, he won back-to-back races. This year, starting off the year, he's won back-to-back races. I've done good with him, don't get me wrong, and Sniper's probably still got a little more talent than Egbert, but too many Egberts, I would definitely say, is probably my best claim.
Yeah, he's a very talented horse, and second on opening day at Fort Erie this year. We're running out of time, believe it or not. So before you go, I want to ask you, about your hobbies and what you like to do when you're not at the racetrack, which is probably a rare day.
Yeah, well, my most favorite thing to do is I coach my son's baseball team, and he's just a up here they do it, so he just passed the t-ball stage, so now they're like down there you'd be doing coach pitch now or what have you, but we use like a pitching machine up here, so I really enjoy it. I've coached him for 3 years now, and you get a bunch of kids out there, and might be tougher to deal with 13 little kids out there coaching them than it is to train a whole barn full of horses, but it is fun. It's very enjoyable. We go to the baseball games all the time. My son loves baseball, and really my I love football as a kid, but I really I play baseball and I play football, and but baseball, I absolutely love baseball, and we go to the Blue Jays games all the time because that's the home team here, and I've got to see Vladdy Guerrero Jr. I don't know if that name rings a bell.
Oh,
but
yeah.
He's a big prospect out there, and he's finally up at the major league level, which, I've got his autograph in his minor league team, and I got his autograph with his major league team, and, we like to go out there and pretend like we're super fans, right? So, and basketball. I love basketball, too. Always been a true Blue fan. They always give me a little disappointment at the end of the season, but we bleed blue, right? So, my son even loves him. He loves coming to Kentucky, and he loves Kentucky basketball. And he always asks me, when we gonna move to Kentucky? he loves coming down there. I go to my grandma's house in Nicholasville,
You're raising him right. You're raising him right. Thanks, Preston, for taking the time out of your busy day to spend some time with us. Special thank you to my producer, Lee Della Pina, for keeping us in line and on schedule. Remind everybody, the Equine Forum, the show that launched the network, is on Saturday morning, 8 a.m., Sirius 219, XM 201, live from Belmont Park. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy Johns of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.